OK, thanks a lot. So first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to talk about my research here. So basically, what I want to talk about are new ways that we were looking at how you can probe synthetic systems of matter and how you can probe, for instance, topological order in correlated many-body systems. So that's the specific subject here. But I will show you that basically we will use impurities at the end of the day to probe, let's say, complicated quantum systems. Okay. And so the concrete systems that I have in mind are systems with artificial gauge fields. So first of all, it looks rather simple. You have a lattice, and you have particles. Some, you know, it could be bosons or fermions, and they hop between these sites with some hopping amplitude j. And then you make these hopping amplitudes complex. So they you have some complex phases around here. You have an artificial gauge field. The Hamiltonian still looks rather simple. But if you look at the famous spectrum, the Hofstadter butterfly, you can see there's lots of non-trivial structures. So this is, you tune this alpha, which is the Hahn-Off-Bohm phase per plaquette. This is the energy. And you can see there's a very non-trivial structure. So you might wonder, what is it that distinguishes all these states? And of course, it's the topological order of these states. That's how these different phases here in the spectrum are different. And so the question I want to address is, how can we detect this topological order in these states? So first of all, in these non-interacting systems, but then also in interacting systems, when you take this essentially this setup and add interactions to them. Okay? So the experimental systems that I have in mind could be systems like these. So you could think of circuit QD systems where you have microwave cavities like this. they form a lattice. And on the links of the lattice, you place, for instance, superconducting qubits. And then essentially, you can realize these artificial gauge fields here. And another option would be to use a setup like Mohammed has done experiments in. So you take silicon photonics, essentially. And so here you can see you have little ring cavities, and they are coupled. And if you choose the radii of these rings correctly, you can also get artificial gauge fields. OK, so these are just two examples. Ultra-cold atoms would be another example. What's cool about these systems is, in both cases, you can, in principle, think of adding interactions. And that will become important later. So in that case, of course, the superconducting qubits provide strong nonlinearities already. And in this case, one could, in principle, think of coupling to Rydberg atoms or quantum dots and things like this. So nonlinear optics is also accessible in these systems. OK, so here's an outline of my talk. I want to start by giving you, by making some remarks on topological order, what it is, what it means in general. Then I want to discuss non-interacting systems, how you can measure topological order in non-interacting, essentially band structures. So here we'll refer to experiments that have been done with ultra-cold atoms, but I think the ideas will carry over to optical systems as well. And the main part of the talk, and the second part, I will talk about how you can generalize these schemes here to correlate many-body systems. In particular, I will talk about fraction quantum Hall systems and Laughlin states. OK, so what do I mean with topological order? Well, what I'm interested in is essentially different phases of matter. And so there's this Ginzburg-Landau paradigm where you say you have different phases of matter, and you can distinguish them. Well, there's a phase transition, and then you have trivial states which are symmetric, and then you have non-trivial states which have some order. They spontaneously break a symmetry, like, for instance, a ferromagnet, and you can characterize them by some local order parameters, which you don't have on that side. Okay, but then topologically, ordered states of matter are different in the sense that, first of all, they are both symmetric. So you still have a phase transition where the system becomes critical, but on both sides, the states are completely symmetric. So you cannot understand their difference in this way, but you have to come up with a new concept. And this concept introduced by Wen at MIT was to look at entanglement. So one way you can think about it is that the symmetric state is essentially equivalent to a product state. And with equivalent, I mean that you can transform the state that you have, the ground state, into a product state just by some local unitary transformations. Okay, so essentially, you locally mess up the state, and you're still essentially have a product state. But then the topologically ordered state, on the other hand, is a state which by no means can locally be mapped on a product state. So you really have to do something non-local to the state, introduce long-range entanglement in the system, and then you get this topological state. And so the question I really want to address in this talk is, if you have a state in this class here, how can you measure that it is in this class, and how can you characterize this long-range entanglement? Okay. So let's think about this definition some more. So this is quite a strong statement, right? Because I'm saying that really, essentially, you know, if I want to come up with some number, a topological invariant, which distinguishes these two states, it has to be invariant. It may not change under almost any local unitary transformations, right? So really, the only constraint is locality. And so a quantity that's invariant under unitary transformations are actually overlaps, right? So if you take the system and let's say you add some continuous symmetry, okay? You say you have some continuous symmetry of the system, so you can take some parameter phi to phi plus phi naught, and that could be, let's say, gauge symmetry, where you can take the U1 phase of your system from 0 to 2 pi. So if you take that, and then you can go and form overlaps of wave functions, okay? So you can take a ground state at some value phi of, let's say, some flux that you introduce through in the center of a large 1D system. And you can take these overlaps and get some invariant, which will not change, you know, if you apply unitary transformations. So, and the idea is that that's more or less the only thing you can do if, you know, if you want to be invariant under arbitrary unitary transformations. So if you go and calculate this guy and make these different, so if you, so this is a discretization, right? So these phi j's, if you make them continuous, this expression immediately goes to this integral here, which you can see is the Berry phase, exactly, okay? So that's one way of connecting this very, let's say, theoretical definition of topological order to this particular invariant, the Berry phase, okay? And it turns out the topological invariants that people define to distinguish phases are exactly these Berry phases, okay?
So sorry, but how do you see that this correspond to long range?
Well, okay. So it turns out.
I'm asking a different question. Mm-hmm. This definition does not require any interaction. It's also for free system, right?
That's
so
true.
What does it mean, long range entanglement for free systems?
Well, so okay. So I'm always talking about gapped systems. So if you have a free system, I essentially want to think of a band insulator of fermions.
Yeah.
So they don't interact, but still it's a many-body state, right?
So you include also the symmetry of the wave function?
In some sense. Well, in what sense do you mean, symmetry?
Because if there was no, because of the anti-symmetry, there is no statistics gives you non-trivial.
In that sense, yes, but
otherwise it would be a product wave function to start with.
Yeah, so I mean the only thing that I really need here is essentially that I have a gapped state, so that I have some adiabatic theorems. Okay, so as long as you have a gapped state, you're fine. It doesn't have to be bosons or fermions, and so you know if you have a band insulator, it's gapped. That's good. If you have an interacting state of bosons, it's gapped. That's also good.
No. So probably I'm missing what the entanglement in what. So I'm just.
Oh, okay. So let's say entanglement in this sense really just means you can't write it as a product wave function easily. Okay. So the name is there's no simple witness in some sense. So it's not. I mean, entanglement entropy of this topological entanglement entropy is some measure of precisely this entanglement here, but. It's not as simple as, you know, it's in the Bell state or something, so. Okay, I guess that's, I don't have a better answer to that.
I just want also to clarify, I mean, this integral, mm-hmm. where is the loop? Is phi complex or what?
So phi, in this case, I'm really thinking of some periodic variable, and that could be, let's say, the flux. Let's say you take a 1D system like here, and you change the magnetic flux through the system.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. you make, loop integral. So you change it by two different ways.
I really want to change it by from 0 to 2 pi, and I know that the wave function comes back
so
to itself.
This circle is just to confuse us. Okay.
Sorry. So the circle.
Circle on your integral.
Yeah, the integral. Mm-hmm. It's just integral from 0 to 2 pi.
Yeah. It has to like the wave function at 0 and 2 pi have to coincide. That's why the circle goes here. Yes. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying. Okay. Good. So. Okay, now that I argued that what you want to have is a phase which distinguishes these different states, of course the idea is to measure this phase, and to measure phases, what you want to do is use interferometry. Okay, so and that's what I will motivate in the rest. Okay, good. So the simplest model where you can actually realize all this stuff is the Susch-Riffer-Heger model. So you think of a simple band structure with alternating hopping amplitudes T1 and T2. And in a tight binding model, you just have a two-sided unit cell. So you have a block vector U of k, which has two components. And then you can go and calculate this Berry or Zak phase by changing the quasi wave vector over the Brillouin zone. So that's this, exactly this loop integral that we just had. That's the Zak phase. And if you make some considerations, you will see that because of the inversion symmetry of the model, the result is actually quantized to 0 and pi. And you can visualize this by looking at the Bloch vector corresponding to this Bloch wave function on a Bloch sphere. And because of the inversion symmetry, it's restricted to the equatorial plane. And the Zak phase is nothing but half of the winding number around this loop. Okay, so 0 corresponds to the Bloch vector not winding at all, and pi is when it winds around once. Okay, so that's nice, and this can actually be measured in ultra-cold quantum gases. So that was done in the Gruff Emanuel Bloch, and what they did is they realized exactly this band structure, loaded the BEC and the band minimum, and they used a two-component BEC. So they created a superposition of spin up and spin down, and then what they did is they applied a magnetic field gradient, so the spin down would undergo Bloch oscillations, and this is our momentum space to the left, and the red one to the opposite side, until they reached the edges of the Brillouin zone. And at that point, they recombine these two condensates, measure the relative phase, and that's precisely this geometric phase, the Zak phase that you pick up here. And in the measurement, they could show that it's actually quantized to 0 and pi. Okay, so you can see that the second important ingredient here is actually Bloch oscillations. So you want to combine Ramsey interferometry with Bloch oscillations, and then you can measure these topological invariants. Okay. Good. Now, you might ask, well, you know, this you can essentially do in these simple band structures if you have a single band. So one question you can ask is, what if we do the same? So we look at Bloch oscillations, but in a two-band system, okay? And one simple two-band model you can think of is graphene, for instance, okay? So you have, let's say, a honeycomb lattice, and let's first of all just look at what the wave function does if we apply a force to it, okay? So then the evolution is given by the Bloch Hamiltonian H, and the momentum K is now time-dependent because we apply the force. And then we don't only have the Hamiltonian, but we also have this term here, which describes non-adiabatic transitions from one band to the other. So that's this A matrix here. And now something interesting happens if you go to the limit and increase the force. Okay, so you can see that this term becomes less and less relevant. This term dominates. And if you're in this very large force limit, you can actually neglect this term completely. And if you write down the propagator for this entire evolution, it looks like this, and that's called the Wilson line. You can see it's the exponential of an integral over this A, which is called a Berry connection. And if you compare it to this equation that we had for the Berry phase before, you can see it's essentially the same, except that there's one little difference, which is that this A guy has a hat, so it's a matrix. Okay, and it's a 2x2 matrix because we have two bands in our system. So it really describes transitions between these different bands. Okay, and so now, of course, the idea is to go to this regime of large force and measure this guy. And that's what they did in the experiment in Munich. Okay. So let's see what happens. So they actually, again, they load the BC and the band minimum at the gamma point. And then they go through these different points marked with these different colors here. And they look at the population in the first band that they get as a function of the force that they apply. Okay. So let's first start here at very weak force, so force is essentially zero. You can see all population is in the first band, and that.
What is the force in graphene Hamiltonian? I mean, how it enters to the Hamiltonian? What is it coupled to?
So first of all, I just take this.
It's like electric field.
It's like an electric field. Yeah, yeah. In these cold atom experiments, it's actually some laser phases, but you can think of an electric field. Yeah. Okay, so if we start with weak force acting on the particles, all the population stays in the upper band, and that's clear because you essentially follow the band structure adiabatically, okay? So, and note that the Dirac points are somewhere here, so if you go along this line, you always have a gap, okay? But then, if you go to very, very strong force, you can see there's a slight decay here, and that's just because this two-band approximation that I made is no longer true. You really excite higher bands. But in this regime in the middle, you can see essentially the population really saturates here. And what's interesting is if you look at this point, so this blue point, these blue data points here, they correspond to going from one gamma point to the next gamma point. And so you can see that even in this regime of very large force, although the Bloch Hamiltonian really returns to itself, the population in the large force limit goes to a small value. So that's very different from what you would get, let's say, for Landau-Zener dynamics, right? From Landau-Zener, you would say that if you cross this this point here, if you go back to yourself very fast, you should always come back to your initial state. And in fact, this large deviation that you observe here, which essentially is a deviation from Landau-Zener dynamics, that's exactly an effect from geometry. Okay, that has to do with the band geometry, and that's encoded in this Wilson line. Okay, so in fact, the population that you get here is essentially given by a matrix element of this Wilson line propagator that we wanted to measure. Okay. And so now the question is, what does this Wilson line mean more concretely?
So how do you see from the data that it's geometric?
Oh, I will discuss why in a minute. Okay. Yeah. From the data, it's not easy to see. Okay. So let's try to understand what this Wilson line or these Zach phases also what they mean. So it's actually let's take a very simple picture and say, okay, we apply some external potential, which I can write as F times position operator R. And then I say, well, we apply this force, and let's do a very simple thing and just do essentially a perturbation theory. So we're saying the system will pick up some, let's say, I will call it first dynamical phase, which is just the expectation value with respect to the wave function of this operator, okay? And then I apply this force some time t, so really I should take the integral over this phase, and then I get some dynamical phase, okay? Now if we do that, okay, so it looks like a dynamical phase, but it's actually not. And the reason is the following. So if we want to go exactly by one reciprocal lattice vector, we need to have this condition that the force times the time that we apply the force should be exactly given by 2 pi over, let's say, the lattice spacing, okay? But that means that dt times f is actually a constant value, namely this one. So this guy will not be a dynamical phase, but it's really a geometric phase, which takes a non-trivial value if f becomes large. And the meaning is also clear then, right? Because essentially it would measure the expectation value of the position operator, okay? And if you, okay, it's a bit hand-waving argument, but what it shows you.
Your f is function of time, or you just think it is a box?
It's a box.
So it's completely anti-adiabatic?
Yes. So the idea is the following. In this wave function, I always assume that I'm in the lowest band. So
As soon as you make quench, you
that's true. That's true. So let's say I don't want a box, but I want to switch it on slowly and then keep it at a final.
But then you have some integral from minus infinity to infinity, some function.
Yeah.
Of time.
Yeah, that would be more correct to say.
And then what this condition means here? It's about integral.
It's about the pulse area essentially. So you want to make sure that the t would be so this would be integral over f of t. Should be exactly this way. That's true. Okay, so if you're not super, this can all be done much more correctly if you use Bloch theorem and so on. I just want to give you a hand-waving argument why the Zach phase that you measure is actually given or gives you the expectation value of your position operator in the state. And at the end of the day, what it really does, it really measures the position of the Vanier states in your lattice. Okay. And that's this. So this, if you formulate it correctly, that's this famous theorem by King-Smith and Van der Waal. Okay. Okay. So if we take this hand-waving argument, what we would say is that if we go from one band to two, well, the Wilson line, so, which is essentially something like e to the I times phi Zach, it becomes a matrix, and essentially it measures the position operator, but now with respect to Vanier sites or Vanier functions. Alpha and beta of these different bands. So because you have two bands, your position operator becomes a matrix, and the Wilson line essentially measures this matrix. Okay.
So what do you mean by the position of the Vanier function?
So
you haven't got a picture of a wave packet formed of one Vanier function and it moves with time?
So basically, if you have your Bloch wave function, you can define a Vanier function, mm-hmm. and then what you can do is you can just go and calculate. You take the position operator x and calculate this expectation value, and that's this polarization. And so you know the Vanier function would look like this. They always repeat themselves, So that means that this guy is actually only defined up to a lattice constant.
No, I understand that, but I thought originally you were talking about a state of a given block momentum, you apply a force, k dot is f.
Yes,
so you imagine some transport through the Brillouin zone. So what puzzles me is why you're now talking about the 1A functions.
Well, so if you think in terms of 1A functions, you start at some point, you have certain dual position of these 1A functions, then you undergo one block cycle, and they will come back exactly to the same superposition of 1A functions. That's why I can think about it in real space somehow in terms of 1A functions. Yeah, but that's true. Like in the intermediate steps, it's so I should always look at one block period, because in between I get some superposition which is complicated.
May I ask, F is a vector, right?
So in a 2D system, yes.
Yes, so when you make this evolution, you start from zero, you end at zero, but are you going in one line, or you have a loop?
So far, I'm considering lines only. But it's true. So to get interesting things like churn numbers, for instance, I should really go around loops.
Yeah, but because this is very much resembling adiabatic pumping, when you very slowly change, but you have two-dimensional
That's true.
Change, you have shift proportional to the area of the loop.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's true. So in fact, so if you look at 2D systems, and you look at Zach phases at different values, and you adiabatically go through these values, then the winding of the Zach phase gives you a churn number, which exactly, as you say, measures this adiabatic pumping.
Actually, even in one dimension, it's the same thing like Taulis pump.
Yes, you know? Just need two parameters, x prime. And they should be shifted in phase. If they're in phase, you have nothing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, in fact, I mean, that's what we're after at the end of the day. So if we want to look at 2D systems, we want to measure exactly this adiabatic pumping in some sense. And therefore, the idea is really to measure these Zach phases for one parameter and then, measure it at different values. And then you get, let's say, churn numbers, for instance, in that way.
And your final goal is to measure some free fermion properties, or your final goal is to actually measure some interacting properties?
No, so at this point here, this is all
non-interacting. Yeah, but your
final goal is interacting. I will show you how to do it. Yes. Okay. I want to present you first the results of these experiments that were done in Munich, where we were involved. And so basically, they looked at this honeycomb lattice with A and B sublattices here. And then they moved the population from one gamma point to the other gamma point and measured this Wilson loop, okay? So this matrix. And in fact, it turns out that this matrix is essentially given only by the reciprocal lattice vector G, and the positions are A and RB in real space of these A and B sublattice sites, okay? And so what they did is they measured actually a certain combination of these eigenvectors, eigenvalues of this Wilson loop, and what you get is, if you just do geometry, you get that G times RA minus RB is pi over 3. And that just has to do with the lattice geometry. And so, you know, they did the measurement. They measured this from these population curves that I showed you in the beginning. They read off that this number here, which you can think of as a topological invariant in some simple sense, is, let's say, 1.03 times pi over 3. So this is really one way of characterizing this lattice. And what's nice is if you switch on an AB sublattice offset, so you really change the kinetics of the problem, but not you don't change the geometry of the underlying wave functions, you still get the same value. So this shows that this is actually some topological invariant in some sense, which characterizes this honeycomb lattice. Okay.
So probably I did not understand, because you have to do this protocol at a fixed time once you define the force. So what does it mean in geometric? So the capital T is fixed, so you cannot.
Well, it's fixed by the force, right? So if you go to larger force, you just have to wait shorter. So there's a one-to-one relation. But if the force is very fast, the value that you get is universal. So in that sense, it's independent. It's independent of how fast you go through the system. I mean, through the transition. As long as you're fast enough to get into this strong gradient regime. Okay. So that was essentially what I wanted to tell about non-interacting systems. And now I really want to turn the attention to interacting many-body systems and really ask the question, how can you carry over these ideas that I was telling you about to a correlated many-body system? And here, what I have in mind are, let's say, fractional quantum Hall systems or fractional Schrödinger insulators. I think in principle you can also think of going to other systems, but so that's what I want to focus on. Okay, so the systems, just to be a bit more concrete, I have in mind are really these lattice systems, and for instance, for bosons, I can consider it a Hubbard-like interaction term in addition. So whenever there are two bosons on the same side, you would get some Hubbard interaction U. And in fact, Muhammad was also involved, and it was shown that in these Hamiltonians, the ground states that you get would actually be Laughlin states with Laughlin type of topological order. Okay, and so these correlated Laughlin states, that's what we want to look at and ask whether you can measure the topological invariance of these Laughlin states. Okay, so first of all, the question will be, well, how do we define concretely the topological invariance of these Laughlin states? And so let's again be a bit general and let's say take some many-body system, which is gapped, which has gauge symmetry. So this ring is again now this one-day system that I want to consider. We have many particles sitting on the ring. And then what we can do is we can adiabatically change the flux phi, which goes the magnetic flux phi going through this one-dimensional ring. Okay. Then again, we can calculate, well, in practice, sometimes we can, sometimes not, but we can write down the wave function, this many-body wave function, which is now a function of this phase phi. In fact, it really tells you that you have boundary conditions where if you take one particle around the entire loop, the wave function comes back to itself up to some phase e to the I theta, which is related to this flux here by flux quantum and 2 pi. Okay. So now what you can do is you have this continuous symmetry. You can calculate this Zach phase that you get if you adiabatically change the flux from 0 to 2 pi. But you really calculate it with respect to the full many-body wave function. Okay. Now, of course, one could say, well, let's try to measure this. And of course, that's what people do in numerical simulations. Because there you really have access to this wave function. But if you want to do a concrete experiment, you have a problem. Because first of all, you need periodic boundary conditions, which is not so easy to realize in an experiment. And second, and that's much more severe, I think, you would need to measure the full phase of this, the macroscopic phase of this full wave function. Okay, and that's not easy to do, or even impossible, I don't know. Okay, so now the question is, how can we circumvent that? And the idea is the following. Because essentially, if I introduce this flux in time adiabatically, what that corresponds to is that I act with a force on the many-body system. And the simple way of, it's really just induction, right? So you have a magnetic flux through the ring, so you get an electric field which is going around the circle, and that really corresponds to force acting on the many-body system. So the idea was to act with a force on the many-body system, but in a much more controlled way. So let's say we take this system and we put an impurity particle into the system, and we just apply force to the impurity. But then we want to couple to the many-body system in a good way. So the idea is to actually take out one of these particles, or in other words, create a hole excitation in the many-body system, and then couple the impurity particle to the hole excitation. In that way, you form a composite object, and a composite object of let's say topological excitation and mobile impurity. And then what you can do is you can actually act with a force on the impurity, or in other words, introduce magnetic flux but just seen by the impurity, and then you can measure the phase of this composite object. And in that way, basically the idea is to try to take these single body schemes that I was talking about in the beginning, but apply them not to this many body system, but apply them to these elementary excitations of this many body systems. And the elementary excitations you can really think of as single particles, except that they are a bit more subtle, because you cannot write down a simple field theory. It's not easy to write down Green's functions. They can be fractionally fractionally charged. They have fractional quantum numbers. So these are really complicated objects. But since we couple impurities to these complicated objects, life becomes easy again, because you can write down all these nice concepts for the impurities. Okay. So basically, these composite objects I actually term topological polarons. And again, we at the end of the day, we want to do interferometry. And to this end, we want
to... Actually, just to clarify.
Yes.
When you include this interaction, it's not Liebliger model. It's something different.
No, no. So this is really just a picture. I want to go to 2D systems later.
No, but in this picture, it is Liebliger or no?
Well, this is much more general, right? You could...
No, but you were speaking about Hubbard-like interaction.
It's true. Yeah. Then you can think of a Liebliger thing also. I mean, I think if you...
But then it's exactly solvable.
If you take a 1D system, yes. But then it would be topologically trivial also, right? I expect. So what I want to do, of course, is I want to look at the whole excitation in a 2D system. Let's say a 2D Laughlin liquid. And then it's a different system, but yes. Okay, so again, if the impurity has two different spin components, we can actually use these different spin components to do interferometry with them, okay? So we can have good control on all these degrees of freedom of the particle. Okay. So let me be a bit more precise what the model Hamiltonian is. And so basically, in a simple picture, we can say we have a Hall system that we're interested in. That could be this 2D systems with topological order. We have the interaction between the host particles and the impurity. We have the free kinetic Hamiltonian of the impurity. It's a mobile free impurity. And we have this force, which depends on the spin sigma of the impurity. And that's just the constant force that we apply to the single impurity particle. And OK, I should say, at this point, I do not have to assume that we have periodic boundary conditions or anything like this. But we really assume that we have the single impurity inside the bulk of this many-body system. Okay. And then in a strong coupling language, what we want to assume is that the wave function of this bound topological polaron of this composite object is a product wave function of this of the quasi-particle excitation that we're interested in, and the impurity, which is tightly bound to this excitation. Okay.
And but why only one quasi-particle? Can it be three also?
Three?
I mean, when interactions mix one particle excitations with two, three, uh-huh. Five.
So with quasi-particle, I already mean a collective an elementary excitation of the many-body system.
So you don't want to consider finite lifetime of quasi-particle?
No, I don't want to do that. That's true. But in topologically ordered systems, you would get. I mean, that's no issue because they have an infinite lifetime. They have zero energy excitations, really.
So basically, it's free particles.
No. So the underlying particles would be strongly interacting.
No, but quasi-particles are...
Oh, yeah.
It can be mapped on free particles.
That's true, yeah, except that you have to be careful, right, because they have fractional quantum numbers and so on. But yes, that's the idea. Basically, they're free particles.
But it's only certain approximation. I mean, topology doesn't mean... integrability. I mean, if I will add some perturbation, they will start interacting.
Different quasi-particles, yes. They will, yes. That's true.
So it's only one point integrable in some sense.
So
when they don't interact, right?
So the idea is really I want to think of a system first without any quasi-particles, and then I want to create a single quasi-hole excitation in a controlled way, and just look at this particular excitation. And I want to assume that there are no other excitations around. So then I'm safe.
Yeah, but it's only when your model is integrable. If it is not integrable in a certain time, it will start to decay in many bodies.
I'm not sure, actually. Because we have a gapped system, right? It's gapped. So if you have a quasi-hole...
Then where this quasi-particle leaf is for this gap? Is it ground state?
So that's actually a bit tricky. So maybe we can ask the question, how can you create this quasi-hole excitation? So you can think of starting with a Laughlin liquid, let's say in a box. You have the ground state, but then you adiabatically increase the size of the box and introduce one more flux quantum to the system. And so you really go from the ground state in one situation to the ground state in the next situation. And this second ground state with one more flux quantum, that's the quasi-particle state. So you can see that it's really not an excitation in the sense that you start from one Hamiltonian one system and go to higher energies, but it's really you change the entire Hamiltonian
So you are still in a ground state,
yes,
of system with one extra particle.
That's true. That's how you can think about it.
But half a particle.
Half a particle, one more flux quantum. Yes.
But this is not what is called quasi particle.
Okay. Thanks for pointing that out. So that's maybe that's a bad language. Yes. So that's how should we call it?
Well, ground state zero.
No, and in the quantum Hall language, they would actually call it quasi particle, right? Or quasi hole, depends on. Okay, that's terminology. I agree that it's not the meaning of let's say like quasi particles in Latin liquids. Okay. In any case, if we write down this on.
Short question. I couldn't catch maybe. Why are they bound, and like what's the strong is the impurity bound, or like I guess one impurity is bound to one quasi particle.
So this is a kind of a wish list, right? So I'm writing down this Hamiltonian. I'm saying let's choose the interactions and so on in such a way that this is the actual ground state. And the reason, there's a good motivation to do that because you can think of having one of these quasi particle or quasi hole excitations in these topological systems, put an impurity in, and in some, mean field type of, or what happens is really that the impurity sees a potential, and when there's a quasi-hole, it sees a dip in the potential, right, if there's a density-density interaction. And then you would say that if the interaction of the impurity with the bulk particles is large enough, it will just be trapped in this potential. But this is, of course, just a sketch, and we did exact diagonalization calculations in the end to show that these states actually exist. But it's not, you're right, it's not clear a priori. You can construct some limits where it's clear, but...
So this is just for a fractional quantum Hall system, or is this a general statement?
Which statement?
Are you thinking, is this a general Hamiltonian, or are you describing perturbations of a fractional quantum Hall?
In principle, I think it's more general, right? So you can think of taking, let's say, a quantum spin liquid and trying to look at, a couple elementary excitations to... excitation of a spin liquid, you can write this down, but to find the microscopic form of these guys such that you really get stable bound states, that may require some work. So in that sense,
And the spin only occurs in this last term.
Yeah, that's true. That's what I mean. In some sense, the spin for me is just a way to do interferometry, right? Because I want to move one spin one way, the other spin the other way. I can also keep one in place and move the other one around to measure their relative phase. That's why the spin only appears in this first term.
It means who? The spin of who?
The impurity, I should say. It's some auxiliary spin of the impurity.
Do you literally mean a spin or just mean some extra quantum number?
Extra quantum, pseudo spin, yeah. Okay, so if we have this particular form of the wave function now, because it's a product wave function, we can say that the topological invariant of this wave function here, defined as this Zach phase, will be the sum of the quasi-particle quantum number and the quantum number of the impurity. And in fact, for most of the models that we look at, the quantum number of the impurity is trivial. So for instance, you don't want the impurity to see a magnetic field on its own. Then of course, you would get an additional contribution. And then essentially what we're doing is really with this bound state, we are probing the topology of the quasi-particle excitation. Okay. So now the question, of course, is what is the result? So let's be more concrete now and look at Laughlin states. Let's look at 1 over m Laughlin states for the moment. So you have this correlated ground states. And first of all, you can calculate the many-body-Chern number in the usual way. So as I said, you use these twisted boundary conditions, calculate the Chern number, and turns out the Chern number in this case is 1 over n. Okay, so you get a fractional Chern number. The reason why this can be is, Chern numbers have to be integer, but the ground state is m-fold degenerate. So you can say that every of these states shares a Chern number of 1 over n. And in fact, this is directly related to the effective charge E star of the elementary excitations. So you can see 1 over m is exactly E star over E, where E star is the quasi-particle charge. Okay. Now, that's just an equation, and let's see what comes out for the quasi-particle. And my claim is that if we do now the following, we start in this state, we create a hole excitation, bind it to this impurity, measure the Chern number, what we get is E over E star. So it's the inverse of this Chern number, and in that case, that would be M. So the claim is, and I will argue why that is.
Sorry, can you explain what does it mean topological polynomial?
You mean what I mean by?
Why do you call it topological polynomial?
Oh,
is there something special?
It's basically the idea that you have an impurity which is bound to a topological excitation. So it's just by this topological excitation, and it's a mobile impurity. So. Okay, so the Chern number of this guy is actually, or the term of the quasi-product is actually given by n. Okay, and so okay, I will explain you why in a second. But this is interesting because it means that if you measure the Chern number of this composite object, you get not one but m, and that's a direct way of measuring this fractionalization of these states. And you can do that in the bulk. You don't need to couple to the edges. You don't need to rely on any bulk boundary correspondence. But it's purely a bulk probe of topological order. Okay. Now, the question, of course, is, well, why is it m? And so let me explain that. There's a simple picture you can have. So these dots here are the host particles of your system. Those are the real, you know, the real, let's say, bosons that you would have. And then you take a single vortex, that's the quasi-hole excitation. You bind it to this impurity in green. And now let's ask what happens if we take this object and move it once around another particle. So that gives you a Harnoff-Bohm phase of 2 pi because of the vortex, right? If you take a vortex around a particle, that gives a 2 pi phase. Now, what does that mean? Well, if we look at the Harnoff-Bohm phase that you get really determines the strength of the magnetic field that's seen by the impurity, which moves along with the vertex, right? So the effective magnetic field that's seen by the impurity will be given by the effective magnetic field seen by the particles times their density. But so the thing is, the density of these particles here is only 1 over m times the density of the flux quanta, right? So there are m flux quanta for each of these underlying particles. And therefore, the total magnetic field seen by the quasi-particle, which it only sees when it goes around these host particles, will be reduced by exactly this factor of m. Okay. Now, if we have a reduced magnetic field seen by the by this impurity now, that actually means that the Berry curvature corresponding to this guy is enhanced just because of the relation between Berry curvature and magnetic field. Now, if the Berry curvature is enhanced and you integrate it up, you get an enhanced Chern number, which is m now. Okay, and that's the reason why the Chern number of these topological polarons is m, the inverse Chern number of the ground state.
Are you going to explain what your scheme is?
This,
how to move this here?
Yeah, maybe that's a good point. Actually, I should.
My question is that why your scheme boils down to the just going, taking one quasi particle and then going around a real particle?
Oh, no, this is just to argue that you get this reduced magnetic field. So, the way the actual scheme works is it's the following. So the idea is to start with the K. Let's say if the impurity would see just a magnetic field, then you can write, in the lattice, you would write down the Brunner zone. Let's say that's Kx and Ky. And you can say you measure the Zach phase along here. So what you measure is now the Zach phase is a function of Ky. Okay, so this is Ky, 0 and 2 pi. And then you start somewhere here, you measure the Zach phase, and it's, let's say, 0 at some point. So that's for a free impurity, not coupled to the many-body system, but in a magnetic field. And then, in fact, in the same magnetic field that these underlying bosons would see. Okay. Then you go here, and you measure the Zach phase again and again, and what you would get would be something like this, where this is 2 pi. So you can see it goes from 0 to 2 pi, so the winding here, this winding, exactly as we discussed with this adiabatic pumping, this winding would be the Chern number. And the Chern number in this case would be 1.
That's okay.
Okay. And then I will repeat the whole thing, but now when the impurity is coupled to the many-body system, and I will apply exactly the same force to the impurity as in this case. And then my claim is that what you would see is not 1, but in this case, you know, depending on number, what you would see m times winding of the impurity.
How can you distinguish 2 pi from 10 pi?
Mm-hmm. So you can see what you do is you really measure the Zach phase here and here and here. So you really follow it. So of course you cannot, like 2 pi and 0, you cannot distinguish. But you can see that the winding you can see, right? Because it, you really look at how it changes. You integrate up small changes. So it's true. So if you, let's say, if you, you're at some point and you're, there's a gap almost closing, so that, let's say, the actual, like maybe in theory you calculate that there's like almost a divergence, of course you can miss that. So it's all relying on the hope that, you know, the state varies sufficiently slowly. But in the experiment, that should be fine. Okay. Good. So I'm not sure how interested people are, but so you can also, this simple argument here was just to show that the magnetic field is reduced and so on. You can also write down an effective field theory for this to make exactly the same argument. And I don't know. So maybe I just sketch it. Essentially, you describe your many body system with topological order with this Chern-Simons action. You have some K matrix here, and then you so these little small a mu are the gauge fields. There are some relations, the gauge fields, to the actual physical current of the many body system, and then you couple to the external gauge field, that's the magnetic field seen by the host particles, and then you couple the little a gauge fields to the JIs, which are the quasi-particle currents. So you, because you also want to describe these quasi-holes or quasi-particles in your system, and that would be some universal low-energy Hamiltonian. Now, you, from this Lagrangian, you can actually go and calculate, for instance, the many-body Hall response, which gives you the Chern numbers. And the Chern numbers, in this case, it turns out, are just the sum over all different. So Js are the different sectors taken into account in these K matrices. And so essentially, you sum up the effective charges Ej star over E. Okay, that was this expression that I essentially showed you before. Okay, so that, these are just the bulk quantities. And then you can go and say, well, let's couple the impurity particle to the quasi-particle. So J mu is now the current of the impurity. And I take the impurity and couple Li, that's an integer, particles of type I. So the current of the quasi-particle current of type I will be given by the number of quasi-particles times the current of the impurity, right? Because I'm assuming that they're tightly bound together. And then if I integrate out the little a gauge fields, I get an effective Hamiltonian, Lagrangian for the system with, okay, some, this is Chern-Simons action for the external U1 field. There's fractional statistics here for the impurity now. Okay, I don't want to go into the details. This is the important part. You will see that, there will be an effective gauge field here, and if you evaluate this expression, it turns out that you get exactly this reduced effective field Ez star, which is reduced by these quasi-particle charges, and that was all that we needed to derive this expression for the Chern number. Okay. Okay, I don't want to give the details here. Maybe just jump to the numerical results that we did. So we used actually this lattice model. We used, in this case, fermions. First, we looked at the one-third Laughlin state, where the Chern number is 1 over 3. And then we calculated the Zach phase for this bound state, so using an exact calculation. And you can see, indeed, the Zach phase would now wind by exactly 3 times. So that's 1, 2, and 3. Although you have to be quite precise at the edges.
And what is the microscopic Hamiltonian with which you bind the impurity to the quasi holes now in this case? So there's one question, and the other one is you have nearest. What kind of interactions do you have here?
So because it's fermion, it's spin polarized fermions, I have nearest neighbor interactions for the fermions. And for the impurity, I take the impurity on the exactly same lattice, but without gauge fields. And then I take really local impurity fermion interaction, purely local.
So you have long-range interaction, but it's written here.
Here? No. Okay, so this refers to nearest neighbors. So M and N are the axes, and I'm just looking at nearest neighbors.
And why don't you look at the 1/2, which should be much more stable than this one?
Well, we actually found it's not more stable. So in fact, it's a bit tricky. So it's not so easy to do these calculations on these lattices because you need rather big alphas, which is, you know, a rather big flux per plaquette, because otherwise you have, if you want a large system, you would get many sites. You cannot do that. If you have large alpha, though, the quasi-particle becomes dispersive, and then it's harder to bind the impurity. So it just happened. I mean, we played a bit with it. It turned out that for 1/2, it wasn't that stable for some reasons. One thing we also did is we actually include long-range hoppings here. Then it also becomes more stable. So yeah, with the details you can play. I mean, I should say this is really just a proof of principle kind of thing in some sense, because the system is really pretty small. So I think these were
One half you could just add long range and then flatten the band, so all the dispersion.
That's true. Yeah, you can certainly play with it. I mean, we didn't optimize it. We just wanted to show proof of principle, like that it works.
And then what's the answer to the first question?
Which Hamiltonian was?
The Hamiltonian for the coupling of these impurities.
No, it's purely local density-density interactions.
It's repulsive?
It's repulsive because you want to bind to the holes, yes. Right. Okay, so...
Sorry, could you explain the scheme? Like, I take this, I bind it, so
yes.
I turn on the coupling, and then I go around and then turn off the coupling and then read the phase. How do you read that phase?
So the preparation in general is problematic. So what I have in mind is, let's say, some engineering kind of thing. Like, you start with no particles, you create a quasi-particle. Then you, let's say, add the impurity and... let's say you hope that it's in the bound state. And then the impurity has spin. So the first thing you would do is really apply this Ramsey pulse to create the superposition. And then, as I was drawing here, right? So you move the spin in opposite directions first at say this ky. Measure the phase by recombining the two spins of the impurity. And you just repeat that over for different ky. So. Okay, and let me summarize. So basically what I showed you was that to measure geometrical phases, which distinguish topologically ordered phases, you can use Bloch oscillations and combine them with Ramsey interferometry. And then in the many-body case, I showed you the basic idea was really to couple this impurity to the elementary quasi-particle excitations of the many-body system. And I think this idea, I mean, we applied it to measure topology, but I think it's more, and that's more generic, right? So you can try to measure to bind impurities to elementary excitations, and in this way, measure the properties of the excitation, and thereby characterize the ground state phase. So that would be one outlook, and you can go to other phases too. And with this, I want to thank people involved in the project, and thanks for your attention.
So, questions?
Yes. If you go for the Hofstetter butterfly at large flux, you'll have all kind of churn numbers already in the spectrum. Now, how do you convince me at the end of the day that you didn't just measure one churn number in an excited band with your quasi particle? Because you don't really address the actual nature of the ground state. You don't target any exchange phases or anything. You only target the fact that the quasi particles see less of the magnetic field. But this is the same effect as having just a higher churn number in a higher band.
That's true. I mean, of course, like we change parameters adiabatically. So you would, first of all, you take a Hamiltonian and make sure there's just one quasi hole, and then you adiabatically switch on the coupling to the impurity. So you try to make sure that you really always stay close to the ground state. But of course, in the concrete numerics, it's correct that if we have strong coupling, that's true. So if the coupling of the impurity to the underlying bosons is so strong that it really mixes all these bands, we should be messed up. And in fact, that's what happens also. So the churn number would change if you have too strong interactions. Typically, it would become trivial, but...
And then you target it at a cold atom system in a trap. How is it going to be ever only one quasi hole?
Well, so the hope would be, of course, to make sure that the density of these quasi hole excitations is small enough so that you can assume they're independent. So I think in practice this is, of course, that's hard to do, right? To make sure that that's the case. I mean, we didn't think too much about it in some sense because people can't even create these quantum Hall states yet. But I mean, since the overall goal of that community would be to couple things to these quasi-particles, we thought it's fair to think about it theoretically. But I mean, it's true. It's a tough question.
I just want to understand, in original quantum Hall activity, people were speaking about composite fermions, which allow to connect fractional quantum hole with real quantum hole. I mean, what you're doing is basically creating by hand this composite fermion.
Yeah, it's so in some sense, it's true. So the thing is, I think the following creature applies. I guess that's what you mean, right? So you can take a quantum Hall system, introduce a flux quantum, which is this quasi-Hall excitation, and then we couple the impurity to the Strux quantum, and they are bound together. So in some sense, this composite object is some composite fermion in that sense, right?
Yeah, but then what kind of experiment you would propose to do for, you know, gallium arsenide system?
Oh,
because they have this composite fermions, they see all this, you know,
symmetries. But for them, it's hard, of course, to do interferometry because of short coherence temps, for instance. And it's hard to get this control, this, you know, over individual composite fermions, so, or over individual impurities. So I'm not sure if you think it works, it would be cool.
No, I mean, you have free particles, you have bands, and what would you like to measure?
Well, I would want to measure the Chern number of these bands, right? Of these many-body states, I would say. Somehow I need to do interferometry, right, to measure these phase. I mean, of course, transport experiments are a different way of doing it. But, I mean, of course, this scheme is more direct in some sense, right, because it really addresses this nature of these phases being geometric phases. but in linear response, it's all the same, of course.
If I may, I can make just one statement. It's actually, you mentioned Pilsen loop. I think it's fair to call it Wegener-Wilson, because Wegener was actually a couple of years before Wilson introducing all this stuff.
Thanks.
In our community, we should not give too much to this kind.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.